The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
There's this kind of larger question about the role of social media in our politics, right? Social media has changed or at least amplified and accelerated a lot of media trends that reward sort of more extreme speech, more sensational speech, more vitriolic speech. What I think, as a sort of analyst of these topics in my sort of think tank job outside of the committee, is that there's a sort of dangerous feedback loop in which politicians are rewarded for kind of more combative, sometimes more violent rhetoric. That feeds into the social media ecosystem, generates a ton of engagement, a ton of media activity, then thus strengthening the incentives for politicians to conduct that behavior again.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, a senior editor at Lawfare, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, February 8th, 2023. The January 6th committee released its final report on December 22nd, 2022, the capstone of a year and a half of investigative work. But while the report is 800 pages, there's a lot that it doesn't include. The Washington Post recently reported on the work done by investigators looking into the role of social media in enabling the insurrection, work that wasn't incorporated into the final document. Today on the podcast, we're excited to bring you a conversation with one of the staffers who worked on that investigation. Dean Jackson is project manager of the Influence Operations Researchers Guild at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. He served as an investigative analyst with the January 6th committee, investigating the role of social media in the insurrection. We talked about his experience working on the investigation and what his team uncovered, and walked through what got left out from the final report. It's the Lawfare Podcast, February 8th, a January 6th committee staffer on social media and the insurrection.
To start off, can you just tell me about your role on the January 6th committee? What work were you doing?
I joined the committee really as a consultant in March of last year. They had a sudden need for someone to come in and make a real run at the social media components of their investigation. They had a few staff dedicated to this, but they were sort of split part-time across other issues. And the volume of documents and witnesses and other information that was incoming was so great that they really needed somebody who could kind of immediately jump in and start sorting through it without needing to be sort of briefed on all of the background about social media and extremism. And, you know, I've worked in the think tank space for about 10 years, mostly on kind of disinformation, democracy, and social media topics. So I happened to be in the right place at the right time and was able to do that for them. I stayed for about 3 months, leaving right before the hearings started, and just really made as big of a swing at the big companies under the investigative portfolio, which were Meta, Twitter, YouTube, and TikTok, kind of in, I would say, roughly that order of time spent on each platform. And, you know, I continued to sort of, as needed, weigh in and contribute to the ongoing investigation. But when I left, they were really pivoting into packaging their findings for the public. And so my contribution was really just to move the ball forward as fast as I could in the time that I had.
How did the social media portion of the investigation interact with the other prongs of the investigation? You had a very involved color scheme.
We did, yeah. And I think I'm not violating any NDAs if I break here that I believe the color scheme was actually inspired by the Infinity Gauntlet from the Avengers. but we were all on color-coded teams. And the team I sat on was called the Purple Team. I think the rationale where there was that there was a red team which focused on extremists and a blue team which focused on kind of law enforcement failures. And the purple team kind of had people working on both of those issues as well as the social media component. So it was really a sort of blend of topics, and we were asked to step back and look at the broader context around the attack, right? Not necessarily things that happened on the day of, right? There were people who were interviewing people who were there. We were thinking about the months leading up to and the social context and sort of how we got to the point where something like January 6th was possible. So how it interacted with the rest of the committee, you know, I think my colleagues who worked on extremism had relationships with their colleagues on the red team, and they would join each other for depositions or share, you know, documents as relevant. I really, you know, kind of burrowed into the social media stuff, which was really uniquely purple team. But I did have relationships across the committee. We kind of shared a sub-basement with the green team, which was focused on money trails. And we got very close with them. And it was, you know, a good group of hardworking people. And so anytime you needed something from somebody, you just kind of had to run it up the chain and ask.
So before we get into the substance of what you found, I want to talk a little bit about the investigative process. We know just from public documents that have been released, the committee sent out a number of subpoenas to tech companies. There's a draft report that you put together, which we'll talk about in a bit, that shows that the committee received briefings from some companies and conducted depositions with witnesses who had worked there. From your perspective, what was it like to be conducting this work? Was it like pulling teeth to get information? How easy or hard was it?
It was very interesting because, like I said, I came in and kind of had to hit the ground running very quickly. So it was really something to walk in, you know, the first day and be handed a binder and told, you know, this is from a witness whose identity needs to be protected, and these files don't exist digitally. Keep this locked in a drawer, which really happened. But some people were willing to talk to us on record. You know, I kind of felt like a journalist in many ways because I would reach out to people. Sometimes they would ignore me. Sometimes they would get back to me, and then I would tell them, look, we can have a conversation in which I use your name for the congressional record, and you go down in history as someone who spoke to us about this, or I can attribute it to someone anonymous that isn't as helpful for our report and our evidence process, but you know, you've got to protect yourself. Or we can have coffee and this can just live in my head and help inform the rest of the work I do, but never go on paper. And people availed themselves of all of those options, just depending on their individual circumstances. You know, it was easier to talk to ex-platform employees, of course, because if you work at a company and you're talking to Congress about that company's lawyers will really insist on being involved. But, you know, I was able to sort of scout out a few relevant people who we wanted to talk to, as well as I spent a tremendous amount of time just wading through tens of thousands of pages of documents. That we use a sort of legal software to triage and find sort of like relevant documents or documents that are related to one another. But it was a lot of material to sort of read and process, and it's difficult, I think, for outsiders to parse because sometimes they're email chains without much broader context or memos that might be very technical. You know, a company like Facebook is sort of its internal organization is very fluid. And so it's difficult without spending a lot of time on it, thinking about it, to understand what part of the company, like the thing you're looking at, might represent and whether or not it's the full picture. And so that was also very time consuming, just spending a lot of time with those documents. We also received briefings from platform staff. They would volunteer people to come forward and talk to us about sort of specific topics on which they had kind of specialized knowledge. It was a pretty wide ranging investigation. We used human sources. We used sometimes things in the press. You know, you don't need to ignore the open source just because you have access to privileged information. But I needed to get a significant amount of work done in a relatively short amount of time so that, you know, so we could make sure we'd done our due diligence on this issue.
Were there particular companies that stuck out as particularly easy or hard to work with?
It was interesting to see them all use different strategies in dealing with us. Some of them gave us a tremendous volume of documents, and I think the strategy may have been partially to bury us in paperwork, right? I used to joke that I was investigating more than $1 trillion worth of corporate activity, but the American public just had me. But others, you know, others were not forthcoming and would sort of rely on a First Amendment defense, saying, you know, like, you know, too much congressional inquiry into our content moderation processes could have a chilling effect on our corporate speech rights. We never went to court over that. We were able to get at that element of the investigation through other avenues, but that would have been an interesting court case because, you know, in many previous cases, the courts had found that the committee's sort of uniquely weighty interest in getting to the bottom of the circumstances around the TAC really won a lot of balancing tests in the court of law. And then finally, you know, some companies were very cooperative and put a lot of staff in front of us, but, you know, you had to work with them quite a bit to find the right staff to ask the right questions to. And that can be very time consuming because, you know, just in the scheduling process, it can really draw things out and you can, you know, it can sometimes be a stalling tactic. And you had to be sort of aware that the companies in many different ways were trying to run out the clock. You know, I think they hoped that ultimately they would be exonerated and that they needed to be cooperative or to appear to be as cooperative as they needed to be under the law. But, you know, they were really hoping we would, you know, that they would walk out of this with sort of a clean image.
And so in that respect, was your perspective that the fact that the committee was on a really on a ticking clock when it came to how long it would be around, was that sort of affecting how you were able to conduct the investigation if these companies were able to say, you know, we can kind of string them along because they won't be here forever?
I think so, yeah. I mean, the committee very famously subpoenaed several of the companies before I joined the staff. And that was, I'm going to say it's an unprecedented action. Someone will immediately point out another congressional subpoena that's gone to a corporation. But, you know, it was a big step. And that was because they had not been getting the kinds of information they were seeking. And it took time for those subpoenas to go out. It took time for the companies to then begin combing through their records to comply with the subpoenas. And then, of course, they needed to move staff around to then deal with that volume of incoming content. I mean, the committee was constantly hiring. Like, their people were – at one point, this committee was just like – the members and a few high-level staff, and then it just grew and grew and grew from there. I mean, when I left, they were getting ready for the hearings, and it seemed like there was a new communications consultant every single day. You would just, you know, one day there was one guy at a conference table with a laptop, and he just multiplied into like 12 people by the time I left. So, you know, capacity was an issue just because of the time. The money was no object, but you know, they needed to get this done within one congressional term. And that meant throwing people at it because you didn't have all that long to get the material in, to process it, and then to produce output, right? The last 6 months of the committee's existence was dedicated probably, you know, 90% to hearings, report writing, and making sure that those findings reach the public.
So speaking of findings reaching the public, before we go any further, I want to talk about the elephant in the room, which is that we're talking about the social media portion of the investigation. A lot of that didn't make it in to the final report. So I'm curious what you make of that. Did the committee make a mistake, in your view, in not including it?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's been a lot of discussion around that. I think it's important to back up and recognize, first off, that I really viewed myself as coming in and doing a job on behalf of the committee, right? They asked me to do work. I did it to the best of my ability, but I am not a decision maker in the ultimate findings of Congress. That role belonged to the elected representatives on the committee. And they had a decision early in their work together. They were going to work by consensus to the extent possible. And when you have a committee as diverse as, you know, Liz Cheney to Adam Schiff, that the band of consensus might be rather narrow. And so the committee made strategic decisions about what to focus on. Now, I do think, and I should say also that those strategic decisions in many ways paid off. I mean, those hearings attracted a lot of views. I think it was very smart to focus on a very tight story with a main character for national TV. For the report, I always did hope that they would take a more expansive view, that they would step back and really ask, how did we get to this point? How did extremism in America get this bad that a mob would try to overthrow the election? And are we still in danger? And my strategy would have been, if it were my choice to make, of course, to take the time to reflect on those questions. And the report, I think, would have been the place to do it because, most of the people who watched that hearing are not going to read the report. The report will be read by historians and analysts and journalists, but, you know, not by your average voter. And so in the report, you do have room, I think, to be more thoughtful and to take a broader view. That's a difference of opinion in strategy. Obviously, there were differences of opinion about that between the committee members, and in the end, that's not the choice they made. But I think you can see that there's a great deal of interest in those questions because stuff keeps coming out, right? It's and not just about social media, about other issues too. You keep sort of getting a trickle of new information from the committee's findings. And so those things are entering the public conversation. And I think that's very important because I don't think that the danger of events like January 6th is past or behind us. I think that the risk to American democracy will outlive President Trump's political relevance. And you continue to see isolated instances of violence that point to a larger pattern of the continued risk of really domestic terrorism in the United States.
Yeah, I do want to talk about the continued risk of terrorism along those lines. But before we do that, let's dig into some of the findings that you actually put together. So among the materials that sort of come into the public eye since the release of the formal January 6th committee report is this draft report on social media written by your team, which the Washington Post published in full. So confining ourselves just to the report itself rather than, you know, the process of the Post reporting or anything like that, tell me a little bit about what this document is.
Yeah, so this is the Post published this draft document. I think it's around 122 pages. And it's important to stress at the outset that this is a draft. This is, you know, kind of live work product from the committee. It didn't go through the kind of proofing and quality control and fact-checking process that things that end up in the final report do. It's really, I think, the basis of it was actually a sort of 75-page thing that I wrote as a sort of legacy product, right? Because I was going to continue part-time kind of in the evening as needed, but my full-time with the committee ended at the end of May, and I needed to encapsulate all of the kind of everything I had learned so for their use. And I kind of merged that with some of the work my colleagues had done to create a sort of like summary of the social media findings to that point. Over the summer, kind of after the hearings, I spent some time with them again, like updating that, polishing it, expanding it with any new findings that they had captured in the intervening months. And that's really, I think, what that document in the Post is. I think it is. I don't think it has been changed or updated since that point. I think it is like the work of the social media team as it stood when it was decided that it wasn't going to become a chapter in the report. You know, that was work product that me and three other people spent a significant amount of time on. And it really summarizes, I think, almost all of the findings as we would have presented them to the public if the committee had decided to do that.
So let's talk about those findings then. There's a lot going on in this document, and I don't want to necessarily go through by chapter and verse because that would take a while. But one of the main threads that sort of prominent throughout the document is you write that, quote, shoddy content moderation and opaque, inconsistent policies were a larger contributor to January 6th than the admittedly not insignificant role played by recommendation algorithms. So I do want to talk about the algorithm question. But before we do that, tell me about the role of these shoddy content moderation and inconsistent policies in sort of creating the circumstances under which the insurrection could happen.
Yeah. When you read that sentence out loud, it sounds much wonkier than it did when we wrote it. But so first I want to say, you know, sometimes we fall into a back and forth about like, well, did social media cause the insurrection? And I think that is a straw man argument. I think it's a straw man sort of way of framing the issue. The issue is it's really a due diligence argument we're making. Did social media companies do what they could and should have done to prevent themselves from being used as tools to organize and to popularize the myths behind the insurrection? So with that out of the way, you know, the shoddy content moderation policy, you know, it varies across platform. But, you know, for example, on YouTube, they passed a policy against election delegitimization, I think is the word that a lot of these companies use, you know, denying the outcome of the election in early December after the safe harbor deadline for states to file their electoral votes. But there's a 30-day window in which any new YouTube policy doesn't result in the removal of a channel, right? It just results in sort of a maybe the video is taken down and a warning. But 30 days after the safe harbor deadline takes you actually right up to January 6th. So at a critical time like the interregnum between presidencies, you know, you had this sort of grace period that in retrospect was problematic. And I think it really reflects a mistake many people made to think that, wow, whoo, the voting is over, the election is done, we have a winner, the threat is past, when actually the threat would come just before the inauguration. And you saw that in Brazil too, right? The threat wasn't on election day. The threat came actually in Brazil after the inauguration. You know, at Facebook, they didn't have a policy against election delegitimization, and there's a debate about whether or not that is defensible. But Facebook also didn't have a way to, and this comes out in some of the documents leaked by Francis Haugen too, they didn't have a way to really respond to something like the Stop the Steal movement. They didn't have policy levers they could pull to say, wow, all of this is getting really nasty, really fast across many, many Facebook groups, and we probably shouldn't allow it to continue to metastasize. In a conversation we had with Facebook, they sort of talked about policies they've developed since January 6th about like being able to say, wow, this movement across many groups, wow, it is not accruing sort of strikes for policy violations at a level in any one specific group where we can take it down. It is contributing to a statistically measurable increase in these kinds of harms. And so we can then act against the movement as an actor. At the time, you know, this was a really new idea. They had used it against they had used similar policies against QAnon and other movements, but they declined to do so against Stop the Steal. And that was, you know, that was a mistake. And then Twitter, of course, I think the content moderation issues have become infamous because we were able to get whistleblowers who were involved with those decisions speak about them on the record. And the debate over Twitter's decisions continues with, you know, all of the press coverage of the Twitter files and upcoming congressional hearings. But, you know, at Twitter, people were advocating as early as the presidential debates. And really, I mean, even during the Black Lives Matter protests over the preceding summer about the need to be able to do something about violent speech that that might be coded or that didn't cross a line into direct threat. And Twitter internally debated what to do about that and at the executive level decided not to do anything. And the team was really, you know, the team continued to warn that violence was brewing. And they were right. On January 5th, you know, in a staff meeting of the trust and safety team, they said, you know, people could die tomorrow. And, you know, Twitter has an opportunity to do something to maybe prevent that and is not doing that. And unfortunately, that person was exactly right.
So then, of course, that raises the question of, you know, why didn't leadership at these companies want to take these more aggressive measures? And one of the answers that it seems to me after reading this draft report that you provide is that there was a feeling of intense political pressure coming from the Republican Party and the right that really influenced major platforms like Meta and Twitter. And when it comes to Meta, there's a particular sort of quirk in the organizational structure of the company where the people who are, you know, working on policy matters in DC are overseeing the people who work on what's called integrity. That's something we learned from the Francis Haugen leaks and I think comes through really clearly. But tell me a little bit more about that dynamic across these different companies, because that seemed to me to be one of the major takeaways of what you'd written.
Yeah, I that was a major takeaway for me as well. I think the point about Meta is very important. Like corporate structure, I think, does matter here because there's a public policy team that, you know, gets sort of weigh in and whose approval is required for many content moderation policies and decisions. And the public policy team's incentives and goals are to protect the company from political risk, right? It's not to protect users from the risk of harm on the platform. And those two motives ideally would be disentangled. But it's complicated somewhat by the fact that Twitter, you know, this distinction does exist, and it's actually the trust and safety head who's hedging their bets politically. And now Twitter's a much smaller company than Facebook. I once called Twitter a small company in a briefing, and everyone shook their head at me. But it is really, it's not nearly as big as Facebook. So their corporate structure is, you know, I think in many ways simpler and might not matter quite as much. But You really did see, I mean, at Facebook, there's a documented now pattern of overruling policies to make exceptions for right-leaning publishers, for example, right-leaning news pages. You know, the exemptions around fact-checking policy for political candidates, like there were kind of explicit conversations about like why it would be important for Trump to have or not have those. And Twitter, you really saw like in the reasoning process around this violent incitement policy, a lot of kind of logical leaps, I would say, a lot of cherry picking of data. The team that drafted that policy worked really hard to put together analysis and evidence for it. And the counter arguments that the executives came up with were really not compelling, right? They sort of hand waved away all of that work and you know, were not willing to do it because they knew that these policies would fall disproportionately on right-wing users. I talked to one Facebook data engineer who I think really put this really well. He said that the companies are more concerned with equality of outcome, not equality of process, right? The companies want to design rules that are able to treat people on the political right with a light touch because they're very afraid of accusations of censorship, very afraid of accusations of bias, but they know they need a process in place. So they design processes not with the intent of, say, reducing violent rhetoric as much as possible or reducing divisive content as much as possible or reducing misleading content as much as possible. That is on policies that they can then say, well, this was applied equally across the board and this was the outcome. They don't want to write a policy against violent rhetoric because if it turns out most of the violent rhetoric is on the right, it will look like to some audiences they are censoring conservative speech when what they're really doing is applying a violent rhetoric policy even-handedly. So the even-handed policy application can't be too significant or it'll raise political hackles.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free. Or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I mean, that strikes me as, in some ways, raising a genuinely difficult question for a social media company right now. And I'm playing devil's advocate a little bit here, but let me make the best case that I can make for that approach, which is that, you know, you're a big social media company in the United States. You have a wide swath of users across the political spectrum. There is a large chunk of your user base and a large chunk of the political leadership of the United States, you know, half of Congress, the president, a lot of people in the current administration who really believe that, you know, the election was stolen or, to switch topics, to the pandemic, that, you know, the coronavirus vaccine will harm you or something like that. And you could have a neutral policy that would then wipe a lot of those people off the platform or diminish their reach in some way. But at that point, you have kind of picked sides in a way. So what are companies supposed to do there in your view? What is the best way of resolving it? Is it just to say, you know, damn the torpedoes, we're going to come up with our policy about what we think is the right thing to do, you know, and stick to it? Or is there any extent to which those kind of considerations about the political community that you're serving can acceptably enter into the policymaking process?
This is such a great question. I'm so glad you asked it. You've put your finger right on kind of the pulse of the debate, I think. I think we are asking a lot of corporations to govern this kind of speech. Corporations have also sort of put themselves in the business of privatizing the digital public square, so I don't feel too bad for them. But it's true that it's a big responsibility and that it is a lot of power to give a corporation. I think, I hate to say it because it sounds flimsy as a policy recommendation, but time and time again when I would ask people about this, they would say transparency, transparency, transparency. These policy decisions should actually be happening much more in public view. There should be much more public deliberation and input. And I think things like the Platform Accountability and Transparency Act, which require like more data sharing, are essential because we actually don't know how the sausage is made. One of the achievements of this investigation, I think, is actually kind of pulling off the lid and continuing to shine some public light on how these decisions do get made, because they're important decisions. And there deserves to be a robust public debate between people of different opinions about these things. In that debate, you know, it should be in good faith. I don't think the conversation about social media often is in good faith. But the public deserves to, I think, really scrutinize these types of things, what they're asking platforms to do. I think it would be better if platforms did sort of think about what types of principles and values they want to see, if they value something like, say, quality in journalism, and if they wanted to boost that. That's a decision they could make. That's a decision the public could weigh in and say that would be a good decision. But it's right. It's true that these companies want very much to be seen as apolitical, when really that's impossible, because they are the editors in the way of the internet. You know, whether it's through the content policies that they write and enforce, or don't write and don't enforce, or through the algorithms that they designed to put stuff in front of your eyeballs, they are. And I think they hate this. I honestly think this is very uncomfortable for them. But those are editorial decisions, and so we kind of need some equivalent of a public editor, right? We need some way for the public to weigh in and say, like, no, these are the values we want the internet's editors to be making. And really, maybe, I mean, if you really zoom out, maybe private corporations shouldn't be the editors of the digital public square. But that's an even bigger policy leap.
Right. And this brings me to something I found really interesting in the broader release of materials from the committee. So the draft report cites a number of times an interview with Brian Fishman, who during the insurrection oversaw Meta's policies on what the company calls dangerous organizations. And the transcript of the interview is publicly available thanks to the Government Publishing Office. I would definitely recommend listeners who are interested go and take a look at that tranche of material, because it's incredible. And one of the things I found interesting about that interview with Brian is that he says over and over again that he thinks that Facebook should have taken down material more aggressively in advance of the 6th. And he also thinks that even if it had done that, that would not have stopped the violence, because there was so much anger in the political ecosystem from Trump, you know, giving speeches on Fox News. And so I think that that kind of gets to this tension where the role these companies play, as you say, is extremely important, and yet they're also responding to and existing within the same political and media ecosystem that everything else is. So do you agree with him there?
I thought, you know, Mr. Fishman was very insightful, and I think that interview is definitely worth reading for students of these topics. I mean, one thing that sticks out to me that Mr. Fishman told us was essentially that if there had been a policy against denying the outcome of the election, the hammer would have had to come down on most of the conservative media ecosystem, which doesn't seem like a sustainable response. Now, the thing about, like, this wouldn't have stopped, there's nothing Facebook could have done to stop the violence, that's the straw man I'm talking about earlier, right? So there's a way in which this is sort of, and I'm not the first person to say this, but, you know, political radicalism might be too big of a problem to solve just through tech policy, but tech policy plays a part, and the actions the companies take do matter, and so I think they should be interrogated. And you know, Mr. Fishman also did say that he would have advocated for Stop the Steal to have been, you know, treated as a potentially violent movement, which would have created a more holistic response on the part of Facebook. It would have activated options for content moderators that they didn't have. Now, there's a sort of bigger academic debate to be had about, you know, because one of the points Mr. Fishman makes that I think is very, very important is that the role of violent rhetoric from our political leaders can't be really overstated, and that is becoming more common. I mean, I'm old enough that my, like, political awakening was around the same time as events like the Gabby Gifford shooting, and you had Sharon Angle, who was a candidate for Congress, saying that, you know, if things didn't work out at the ballot box, they could always reach for the bullet box. And at the time, this was kind of brushed off as you know, isolated incidents of disturbed individuals or just overheated rhetoric. But I really think if you follow the trend line, you can see now that we're in a whole new world in terms of the normalization of violent rhetoric by political leaders. And that makes it hard, first off, to distinguish real threats from just campaigning, but it also raises the temperature of politics to a dangerous boiling point, and it takes it to a place where I believe Mr. Fishman says, you know, it's hard to walk back from. Now, there's this kind of larger question about the role of social media in our politics, right? Social media has changed or at least amplified and accelerated a lot of media trends that reward sort of more extreme speech, more sensational speech, more vitriolic speech. What I think as a sort of analyst of these topics in my sort of think tank job outside of the committee is that there's a sort of dangerous feedback loop in which politicians are rewarded for kind of more combative, sometimes more violent rhetoric that feeds into the social media ecosystem, generates a ton of engagement, a ton of media activity, then thus strengthening the incentives for politicians to conduct that behavior again. And I think that Donald Trump helped build and then rode that roller coaster for several years. I think that's a conversation we should have about, you know, it goes back, you know, to what I said about transparency. That's a real academic debate. Reasonable people disagree about it. Informed people disagree about it. To get to the bottom of it, we would need data access, right? We deserve to know what's happening on these platforms, how they work, and the effect they're having on our societies. These are really serious issues. The world isn't run by tech policy, but tech policy definitely has an impact on the world.
So I'd mentioned before that I wanted to go back to the aspect of your report about algorithms. So let's talk about that, because you do write in the report that, and this is the quote, recommendation algorithms are only part of the problem. And that really jumped out at me because it feels like algorithms have really taken a prominent role in recent years in conversations around what tech platforms are doing wrong. I mean, the Supreme Court's about to hear oral arguments in two cases later this month that draws a line between acts of violence and the use of algorithmic amplification on major platforms. So I'm curious for your thoughts on this issue and how you reached that conclusion. Were you expecting that, you know, you would come out with this, or did you go into this thinking that algorithms were a bigger part of the puzzle?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I was prepared to find evidence that platforms pulled punches for financial reasons, right? That they wanted to goose engagement metrics, and so they were hesitant to put in place robust safeguards. And I think there are elements of truth to that. There are probably instances in which that's true, but overwhelmingly, what I found was actually that the political incentives were much more relevant, at least to the 2020 election. I want to be clear that the 2020 election and January 6th were specific moments in time, discrete events with their own kind of motivations and drivers that might be unique. I think you could point to other decisions that are financially motivated. But at the end of the day, you know, reflecting on my own focus on algorithms and my own beliefs going into the investigation, I think first what I really learned was that a lot of this activity was driven by human users, right? The Stop the Steal movement on Facebook grew through invites on Facebook groups, which were sent by actually a very small core of members of those groups sent, you know, a large plurality of the invitations. So and Facebook had taken steps to sort of try and avoid algorithmically recommending civic groups at that time as part of the break glass measures. So this is to say, like, even when the company sort of tries to put the brakes on algorithmic boosting, human activists can use this tool to organize. I mean, that's what it's designed to do, right? It's designed to connect many, many people over vast distances. And that is what the Stop the Steal organizers used it for to great effect. It's also what, Black Lives Matter protesters use it for. So you need to have a conversation about, well, is speed the enemy? Is scale the enemy? Do we want these tools to exist? And I think there are instances in which we clearly do, but there need to be safeguards. I think the heavy focus on algorithms by analysts in this space and by lawmakers is a desire to reach for a technical level to a political problem. Algorithms, if what you're worried about is the quality of the information ecosystem and its impact on politics, algorithms sort of represent a bottleneck. They represent like a place where you can apply pressure and maybe change that flow. But at the end of the day, there are many drivers of political radicalism, right? Many people who are in radical spaces on the internet are in places that don't have algorithms at all, right? 4chan is just a message board. So I think the role of algorithms is important. I think we need to understand it. There's going to be more study on it. But I do think it can be overstated, because at the end of the day, the way these platforms were used for January 6th didn't rely on as heavily on algorithms as I thought. There are other ways in which these people find each other, communicate, coordinate, and carry out offline actions.
So I want to zig and zag a little bit and get to another aspect of what you found, which has to do with the role of law enforcement. I obviously focused on this because this has been a little bit of a bugbear of mine, that the extent to which law enforcement failed to prepare for the insurrection. But I was really noted how, so you say social media platforms did not have significant outreach from law enforcement prior to January 6th and did not receive clear warnings of violence from law enforcement before January 6th. Mostly the warnings that they did get before the 6th were focused on preventing foreign interference. So tell me a little bit about those findings.
Sure. And I guess I'll start by saying that I had a colleague on the Purple team, as well as the entire Blue team, who focused just on law enforcement issues. And so I'm hesitant to wade too much into this because I don't want to step on their toes and mischaracterize their work. One of my co-authors on the memo that was released in the Post also spent quite a bit of time working on the investigation into extremists, and his portfolio on social media was actually like kind of the smaller platforms, which is includes many of the places where extremists kind of hang out and get to be more extreme. So he drove a lot of, I think, the inquiry into law enforcement relationships. But, you know, in the documents we saw, there would be kind of routine meetings between platforms and government to talk about like whether they'd seen any foreign activity. Those meetings were characterized to us as often quite boring. and I think it should be stressed that like the bigger platforms like Facebook and Twitter all kind of they have internal investigators and also hire external firms to do sort of threat investigation. You know, people who write up sort of memos like, hey, there was this violent protest and people on this other alt platform are talking about maybe organizing another one. You should be looking out for signs of this on Facebook. You know, if they try to advertise this on Facebook, you need to have situational awareness. And that's normal. They do that all the time. This is something that frustrates me a lot about the Twitter files. It's like really anodyne regular activity is being characterized as something nefarious. But no, of course these actors talk to each other like they're, you know, they do this to prevent acts of terrorism. I mean, that's the genesis of these relationships. But I think, you know, we were not able to find like an example of, you know, a memo from the FBI that said to Facebook, hey, there's a lot of violent rhetoric about maybe storming the Capitol on January 6th. What's up with that? You know, it just that conversation doesn't seem to have happened between those actors. And that's I think that's probably representative of some of the other things that have been written about the intelligence community's failure to anticipate this attack.
So we've mentioned the Twitter files a handful of times. I think now is kind of a interesting time to be having this conversation, because in many ways, it feels like we're kind of in the midst of a backlash against the same content moderation techniques that you wrote that these companies didn't use enough of in advance of January 6th. There's obviously Elon Musk taking over Twitter, sort of dismantling many of the internal content moderation systems and putting this information out and skewing it about what Twitter did do to moderate content in the past. Meta has just decided to let Trump back on their platform in some form. I mean, when you look at this, what do you think? Does it feel like a move backwards?
I do think, and I say this also as a, you know, a professional who focuses on this space, that in many ways this space is moving backward. This goes back to, I think, the debate about whether or not to have put the social media content in the report in a way, because we talked about how that was a decision based on strategy. But one consequence of that was the possibility that the social media findings that came from the investigation and which are now kind of owned and controlled by the Republican-led House of Representatives would be weaponized to make the exact opposite arguments. In some ways, we sort of teed up a debate about social media content moderation. And it was really frustrating, actually, to realize that there were going to be hearings on this, on some of these topics with some of the people who were involved in the decisions we wrote about. And yet the committee's version of the story wasn't out there. That's changed, of course, now that the memo is in the wild. But I do think that, yeah, the space is moving backward. I mean, Facebook's decision to end Trump's suspension, you know, they said is based on their assessment that the risk of political violence is receding. Well, based on what? Says who? I mean, we've seen multiple acts of political violence in the past year. a lot of people in this space will say, like, well, the 2020 election went smoothly. It's not as if people in camouflage didn't show up to polling places in Arizona to monitor it, right? I think the risk of electoral violence is still very much with us. The public, I think, this goes back to transparency, too. The public should know on what basis that decision was made. Yeah, in many ways, I do think this space is starting to recede. I mean, the layoff of trust and safety staff, I mean, there are fewer resources dedicated to this topic. It's just, it is distressing.
Is there anything that you feel like these major companies have gotten better at since 2020?
You know, I suspect there is. But again, it all goes back to transparency. I can't tell you what kinds of break glass measures were or were not in place for 22, right? I can't. And I do want to maybe linger here on a point that I think Frances Haugen once made. I believe this quote is attributed to her, that if you live in the United States, you get the Cadillac version of social media. We have the platinum standard for content moderation here. You know, I focus a lot on the international context in my day job. And, you know, they don't get that in Brazil. They don't get that in Nigeria. They don't get that in Kenya. So that's important to remember, is that as little transparency as we have and as frustrated we are with that here, the problem's much worse abroad. I mean, Elon Musk closed Twitter's only office in Africa. I think he laid off everyone in Brazil except for a few salespeople. So that's a big problem. Now, the things they might have improved on, I mean, I think it actually is a big deal that Facebook has this coordinated social harm policy, which I mentioned is sort of the one where they can use to say, like, even though the harm isn't concentrated enough to merit a takedown normally, this seems to be kind of a distributed rise in harm that's related to the same actors, so we're going to take action. They didn't have that before. I think it's a smart thing to have. It's a recognition that the problems we're talking about here aren't just caused by organized actors with, like, leaders and payrolls. They're often caused now by more loosely organized social movements. Yeah, I think that policy is a good thing. But, you know, we don't know how it's being applied elsewhere. We still don't have a lot of great insight into it. So, you know, I think there are ways in which they're doing better, but, you know, there are ways in which they're doing worse, and it just varies by platform. It's also really important to note that there are more platforms now. I mean, TikTok was barely a factor in the 2020 election, but, you know, you can bet it'll be a factor in the 2024 election. And that's to say nothing of the, you know, Telegram use, I think, is increasing. We have, you know, significant diasporas in the United States who use apps like WhatsApp or even WeChat, the Chinese texting app, right? There will be other websites and apps before 2024 that are released that will be part of this conversation. And so there was a time a few years ago when if you were working in this field, you really could mostly just focus on like Facebook, Google, YouTube, Twitter, and you'd capture like the bulk of the activity we're talking about. That time is over. Like, you really have to be looking at all of them. And that means that content moderation improvements at one platform have a diminishing effect on the rest of the internet. The problem just gets sort of more disparate and harder to control.
So you've mentioned, obviously, that, you know, the United States continues to struggle with extremism, terrorism, political violence. How prepared do you think we are and social media platforms are for political violence along the lines of what we saw on the 6th? If it were to happen again, would you be surprised? Would you expect that platforms would be any better positioned to counter that?
Yeah, I mean, going back to the decision to reinstate Trump, that Facebook said it did that with sort of new safeguards for public figures. But we've seen how they, you know, those safeguards can be ignored when it's politically expedient. You know, there's no reason for the public to be confident that those choices won't be made again, because they've been made in the past. They've shown us how incapable really they are of not following those incentives. So I don't feel like we are prepared. No, I think, hopefully there have been intelligence improvements. I can't really speak to that. Hopefully we're more aware that risk exists. But I think for us to really be prepared, it would mean taking a hard look in the mirror and admitting that this is a long-term trend that very seriously impacts a large part of the political spectrum, and that it's going to require some sacrifice and backbone really to control. And I what I see actually is an eagerness to move on. I mean, I think you get this in sort of Mark Zuckerberg's public statements and reporting about his attitude, right? Like, he really doesn't want to be doing election work. This isn't why he started this website at Harvard when he was 20, right? this is an annoying part of Mark Zuckerberg's job. He wants to be in the metaverse where they don't have elections and there is no election violence. So
give it time. They'll find a way.
Yeah, well, yeah. So I think there's everyone's sort of, whether they realize it or not, a lot of people are burying their head in the sand and hoping that this passes by. And I'm not convinced that it will.
One thing I was really struck by reading the draft report is how sort of careful and cautious your recommendations were compared to a lot of the rhetoric around tech companies right now, even among people who really do want to throw bombs at the tech companies and really do want to focus on this on both the left and the right. You know, you're not arguing that Section 230 should be repealed. You're not arguing that tech platforms are the root of all evil. You're not arguing that, you know, the algorithm needs to be, whatever that means, needs to be, you know, rooted out or redone and that will solve things. And I think I'm only oversimplifying a tiny bit when I say that that is honestly what a lot of the discourse around tech platforms in Congress sounds like right now. So do you feel, you know, out of step with the zeitgeist at all in making those arguments? Is it harder to communicate them?
So, I mean, I do think to react immediately to something you said, we do need to stop talking about the algorithm as if it were a deity, right? There are many algorithms.
It's capitalized.
Right. So that's just one point is, you know, it's actually a complex series of tools that are used for different purposes, and we should really be having a much more complicated conversation about that. But the recommendations are, I would say, light touch because, first off, we knew this wasn't going to be the place where those big, thorny lawmaking debates get settled. But also, the committee, in ways that might be unusual, really brought in a lot of people who were sort of external experts on these topics and put them on teams with longer-time Hill staffers. And so I was lucky to work with people like Megan Conroy and Alex Newhouse, who are you know, both experts in the field of extremism. I brought my own perspective to this, and we worked with a very talented attorney named Jacob Glick. But we were skeptical, I think, of you know, some of the recommendations around 230, for example. That's a long-running discourse, and it just seems like any way you change 230, you create as many problems as you solve. So we didn't want to go there. We didn't want to try and solve those kinds of questions in that space. But what I really felt when I was trying to draft recommendations was that some of the decisions for which we were criticizing the tech companies, I mean, if you read that transcript with Brian Fishman, he's right that there are trade-offs involved, right? These aren't simple decisions, but I think they are decisions that should be simple to talk about. And if we demystified the tech, pulled back the curtain on the machinery a little bit, you could actually have, I think, like a high school civics conversation about some of these issues. One of the ones I keep thinking about is the issue of false positives and false negatives, right? If Facebook is using machine learning to try and find certain types of content and then demote that content based on the level of confidence that they have in whether or not they're right, which was a thing they did. It was a break glass measure that was apparently very impactful. Data engineers felt this was really promising. This means Facebook is making a value judgment about false positives and false negatives. Is it better to leave up hate speech accidentally or to accidentally remove a call for protest against police violence? Those are the implications of the choices they're making. And they are making those choices for us behind closed doors based on their motivations, their incentives, their read of the situation. Nothing I've just said, I think, is beyond the grasp of a high school civics teacher. And I think it's also something reasonable people can disagree about. You know, I'd love to have a spirited debate over drinks with this with like a libertarian, right? And it is so much more interesting and important and nuanced than the screaming that you hear from Republican senators on Capitol Hill. I think we desperately need to have a good faith debate about this because it is about first principles of free speech. It's about like civics 101 stuff. It just needs to be updated for the machine age, and which is why I really think there should be some kind of like blue ribbon congressional commission to help educate both lawmakers and the public on this. The problem is there's so much bad faith in the space that I feel like it would almost immediately be compromised. But we really desperately need it. And I think that that conversation is both more basic and more important in many ways than the conversations we're having about like tech law or algorithms. It's sort of a philosophical conversation, but it's not one that's beyond the grasp of everyday people.
So I want to close by asking about how you're thinking about your own role right now. You've written a bit about your takeaways from the investigation and just security and tech policy press with some of your colleagues. You're obviously sitting down for interviews. I've seen, you know, writing and interviews with some other staffers from the committee. Now that the investigation is complete, how are you thinking about your own public presence? Is there a sort of a responsibility to speak out about your findings, especially because they weren't included in the final report?
That is such a great question and such a personal one, and I think it's really fun that you asked it. Thanks for the chance to talk about myself. I think of myself as a pretty ordinary guy. I came to D.C. when I was 23 years old. I just graduated with a master's degree in international relations. My first sort of full-time salary job was at a think tank at an international grant maker called the National Endowment for Democracy. I really thought I was going to spend my career doing kind of sleepy think tank research on spreading democratic values abroad. And all of the issues I was interested in and cared about followed me home to the United States. And suddenly I was spending a lot of time thinking about how to defend democracy in my own country. That's the journey that kind of led me to care a lot about disinformation and media and social media and its effect on our political system and our society. You know, that sort of interest is what I carried into the January 6th committee. And coming out of it, I do think there's a responsibility to talk about it, just as someone who, you know, believes in scholarship, believes in public conversation, believes in the value of knowledge and the importance of evidence to policymaking. Now, it's sort of, you know, I didn't really ever think I was going to be here. And actually, I when I got the call to ask, hey, do you want to come work for the committee, I was in the process of buying a house in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where I now live, right? Like I wasn't trying to be a swamp creature for life. You know, I was leaving DC. And so, you know, how I think about my public presence is that I'm probably going to, it gives me some credibility when I walk into rooms with other tech policy scholars. I'm enjoying talking about it. This has been a fun podcast. I think my moment of time in the limelight will fade, and that's okay. But I'm really thinking about all this disinformation and tech policy work, how it actually circles back to like fundamental problems in our democracy. And moving to a state like Ohio, where there are so many big questions around gerrymandering and representation and racial equity and civic engagement, the decline of local news media, you know, these are serious challenges that exist kind of like at a rubber meets the road level in the states, which feel sometimes very distant from Washington. And I'm trying to, you know, sort of reflect back on the things I've learned in Washington and figure out how I can apply them in my new hometown. So, it's sort of surreal to sort of suddenly be talking about these like big national issues with big audiences like Lawfare's when what I really was planning on doing was playing with my dog in my yard.
Well, I hope you can get back to that soon. Dean, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. This was really great.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. You can get ad-free versions of this and other Lawfare podcasts by becoming a Lawfare material supporter at patreon.com/lawfare. You'll also get access to special events and other content available only to our supporters. You can rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts, and look out for our other podcasts, including The Aftermath, our latest Lawfare Presents series on the government's response to January 6th. The podcast is edited by Jen Pacha-Howell, and your audio engineer this episode was Ian Enright of Goat Rodeo. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, thanks for listening.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.